spectral tidal wave of light.
Marvelous,
Paul Duret had whispered, more to himself than to his young companion.
Marvelous. It is at times like this that I have the sense, the slightest sense, of what a sacrifice it must have been for the Son of God to condescend to become the Son of Man.
Hoyt had wanted to talk then, but Father Duret had continued to stare out the window, lost in thought. 10 minutes later they had landed at Keats Interstellar. Father Duret was soon swept into the whirlpool of customs and luggage rituals, and 20 minutes after that a thoroughly disappointed Lenar Hoyt was rising towards space, and the Nadia Oleg once again.
5 weeks later of my time I returned to Pacham, said Father Hoyt. I had mislaid 8 years, but for some reason my sense of loss ran deeper than that simple fact. Immediately upon my return, the bishop informed me that there had been no word from Paul Duret during the 4 years of his stay on Hyperion. The New Vatican had spent a fortune on Fatline inquiries, but neither the colonial authorities nor the consulate in Keats had been able to locate the missing priest.
Hoyt paused to sip from his water glass, and the consul said, I remember the search. I never met Duret, of course, but we did our best to trace him. Theo, my aide, spent a lot of energy over the years trying to solve the case of the missing cleric. Other than a few contradictory reports of sightings in Port Romance, there was no trace of him. And those sightings went back to the weeks right after his arrival, years before. There were hundreds of plantations out there with no radios or comm lines, primarily because they were investing bootleg drugs as well as fiberplastic. I guess we never talked to the people at the right plantation. At least I know Father Duret's file was still open when I left.
Father Hoyt nodded. I landed in Keats a month after your replacement had taken over at the consulate. The bishop had been astonished when I volunteered to return. His Holiness himself granted me an audience. I was on Hyperion less than 7 of its local months. By the time I left to return to the web, I had discovered the fate of Father Duret.
Hoyt tapped the 2 stained leather books on the table.
If I am to complete this, he said, his voice thick, I must read excerpts from these.
The tree ship Yggdrasil had turned, so the bulk of the tree had blocked the sun. The effect was to plunge the dining platform and the curved canopy of leaves beneath it into night. But instead of a few thousand stars dotting the sky, as would have been the case from a planet's surface, literally a million suns blazed above, beside, and beneath the group at the table. Hyperion was a distinct sphere now, hurtling directly at them like some deadly missile.
Read, said Martin Silenus.
From the Journal of Father Paul Duret. Day 1. So begins my exile. I am somewhat at a loss as to how to date my new journal. By the monastic calendar on Pacham, it is the 17th day of Thomas month in the year of our Lord 2732. By hegemony standard, it is October 12th, 589 PC. By Hyperion reckoning, or so I am told by the wizened little clerk in the old hotel where I am staying, it is the 23rd day of Lysias, the last of their 740-day months, either 426 ADC, after dropship crash, or the 128th year of the reign of Sad King Billy, who has not reigned for at least 100 of those years. To hell with it. I'll call it day 1 of my exile. Exhausting day. Strange to be tired after months of sleep. But that is said to be a common reaction after awakening from fugue. My cells feel the fatigue of these past months of travel, even if I do not remember them. I don't remember feeling this tired from travel when I was younger. I felt bad about not getting to know young Hoyt better. He seems a decent sort, all proper catechism and bright eyes. It's no fault of youngsters like him that the church is in its final days. It's just that his brand of happy naivete can do nothing to arrest that slide into oblivion, which the church seems destined for. Well, my contributions have not helped either. Brilliant view of my new world, as the dropship brought us down. I was able to make out two of the three continents, Equus and Aquila. The third one, Ursa, was not visible. Planetfall at Keats, and hours of effort getting through customs and taking ground transit into the city. Confused images. The mountain range to the north with its shifting blue haze. Foothills forested with orange and yellow trees. Pale sky with its green-blue undercoating. The sun too small but more brilliant than Pacham's. Colors seem more vivid from a distance, dissolving and scattering as one approaches like a pointillist's palette. The great sculpture of Sad King Billy, which I had heard so much about, was oddly disappointing. Seen from the highway, it looked raw and rough, a hasty sketch chiseled from the dark mountain, rather than the regal figure I had expected. It does brood over this ramshackle city of 500,000 people in a way that the neurotic poet king probably would have appreciated. The town itself seems to be separated into the sprawling maze of slums and saloons, which the locals call Jacktown and Keats itself, the so-called Old City, although it dates back only four centuries, all polished stone and studied sterility. I will take the tour soon. I had scheduled a month in Keats, but already I am eager to press on. Oh, Monsignor Edouard, if you could see me now, punished but still unrepentant, more alone than ever but strangely satisfied with my new exile. If my punishment for past excesses, brought about by my zeal, is to be banishment to the seventh circle of desolation, then Hyperion was well chosen. I could forget my self-appointed mission to the distant Bikura. Are they real? I think not this night. And content myself with living out the remainder of my years in this provincial capital on this godforsaken backwater world. My exile would be no less complete. Ah, Edouard, boys together, classmates together. Although I was not so brilliant nor so orthodox as you. Now old men together. But now you are 4 years wiser, and I am still the mischievous, unrepentant boy you remember. I pray that you are alive and well and praying for me. Tired. We'll sleep. Tomorrow, take the tour of Keats, eat well, and arrange transport to Aquila and Point South. Day 5. There is a cathedral in Keats, or rather there was one. It has been abandoned for at least 2 standard centuries. It lies in ruins, with its transept open to the green-blue skies, one of its western towers unfinished, and the other tower a skeletal framework of tumbled stone and rusted reinforcement rods. I stumbled upon it while wandering, lost, along the banks of the Hooghly River, in the sparsely populated section of town where the old city decays into Jacktown, amid a jumble of tall warehouses which prevent even a glimpse of the ruined towers of the cathedral, until one turns a corner onto a narrow cul-de-sac, and there is the shell of the cathedral. Its chapter house has half fallen away into the river. Its facade is pocked with remnants of the mournful, apocalyptic statuary of the post-Hegira expansionist period. I wandered through the latticework of shadows and fallen blocks into the nave.
The bishopric on Pochum had not mentioned any history of Catholicism on Hyperion, much less the presence of a cathedral. It is almost inconceivable that the scattered seedship colony of 4 centuries ago could have supported a large enough congregation to warrant the presence of a bishop, much less a cathedral. Yet there it was. I poked through the shadows of the sacristy. Dust and powdered plaster hung in the air like incense, outlining 2 shafts of sunlight streaming down from narrow windows high above. I stepped out into a broader patch of sunlight and approached an altar stripped of all decoration except for chips and cracks caused by falling masonry. The great cross, which had hung on the east wall behind the altar, had also fallen and now lay in ceramic splinters among the heap of stones there. Without conscious thought, I stepped behind the altar, raised my arms, and began the celebration of the Eucharist. There was no sense of parody or melodrama in this act, no symbolism or hidden intention. It was merely the automatic reaction of a priest who had said Mass almost daily for more than 46 years of his life, and who now faced the prospect of never again participating in the reassuring ritual of that celebration. It was with some shock that I realized I had a congregation. The old woman was kneeling in the 4th row of pews. The black of her dress and scarf blended so perfectly with the shadows there that only the pale oval of her face was visible, lined and ancient, floating disembodied in the darkness. Startled, I stopped speaking the litany of consecration. She was looking at me, but something about her eyes, even at a distance, instantly convinced me that she was blind. For a moment I could not speak and stood there mute, squinting in the dusty light bathing the altar, trying to explain this spectral image to myself, while at the same time attempting to frame an explanation of my own presence and actions. When I did find my voice and called to her, the words echoing in the great hall, I realized that she had moved. I could hear her feet scraping on the stone floor. There was a rasping sound, and then a brief flare of light illuminated her profile far to the right of the altar. I shielded my eyes from the shafts of sunlight and began picking my way over the detritus where the altar railing had once stood. I called to her again, offered reassurances, and told her not to be afraid, even though it was I who had chills coursing up my back. I moved quickly, but when I reached the sheltered corner of the nave, she was gone. A small door led to the crumbling chapter house and the river bank. There was no sight of her. I returned to the dark interior and would have gladly attributed her appearance to my imagination, a waking dream after so many months of enforced cryogenic dreamlessness, but for a single tangible proof of her presence. There in the cool darkness burned a lone red votive candle, its tiny flame flickering to unseen drafts and currents. I am tired of the city. I am tired of its pagan pretensions and false histories. Hyperion is a poet's world, devoid of poetry. Keats itself is a mixture of tawdry, false classicism, and mindless, boomtown energy. There are 3 Zen-Gnostic assemblies and 4 high Muslim mosques in the town. But the real houses of worship are the countless saloons and brothels, the huge marketplaces handling the fiber-plastic shipments from the south, and the shrike cult temples, where lost souls hide their suicidal hopelessness behind a shield of shallow mysticism. The whole planet reeks of mysticism without revelation. To hell with it. Tomorrow I head south. There are skimmers and other aircraft on this absurd world, but for the common folk, travel between these accursed island continents seems restricted to boat, which takes forever, I am told, or one of the huge passenger dirigibles, which departs from Keats only once a week.
I leave early tomorrow by dirigible.
Day 10. Animals.
The first down team for this planet must have had a fixation on animals. Horse, bear, eagle. For 3 days we were creeping down the east coast of Equus over an irregular coastline called the Main. We've spent the last day making the crossing of a short span of the Middle Sea to a large island called Cat Key. Today we are offloading passengers and freight at Felix, the major city of the island. From what I can see from the observation promenade and the mooring tower, there can't be more than 5,000 people living in that random collection of hovels and barracks. Next, the ship will make its 800-kilometer crawl down a series of smaller islands called the Nine Tails, and then take a bold leap across 700 kilometers of open sea and the equator. The next land we see, then, is the northwest coast of Aquila, the so-called Beak. Animals. To call this conveyance a passenger dirigible is an exercise in creative semantics. It is a huge lifting device, with cargo holds large enough to carry the town of Felix out to sea and still have room for thousands of bales of fiber plastic. Meanwhile, the less important cargo, we passengers, make do where we can. I have set up a cot near the aft loading portal and made a rather comfortable niche for myself with my personal luggage and 3 large trunks of expedition gear. Near me is a family of 8. Indigenous plantation workers returning from a biannual shopping expedition of their own to Keats. And although I do not mind the sound or scent of their caged pigs, or the squeal of their food hamsters, the incessant, confused crowing of their poor, befuddled rooster is more than I can stand some nights. Animals!
Day 11.
Dinner tonight in the salon above the promenade deck with citizen Haramis Denzel, a retired professor from a small planter's college near Endymion. He informed me that the Hyperion first down team had no animal fetish after all. The official names of the 3 continents are not Equus, Ursa, and Aquila, but Creighton, Allenson, and Lopez. He went on to say that this was in honor of 3 middle-level bureaucrats in the old survey service. Better the animal fetish. It is after dinner. I am alone on the outside promenade to watch the sunset. The walkway here is sheltered by the forward cargo modules, so the wind is little more than a salt-tinged breeze. Above me curves the orange and green skin of the dirigible. We are between islands. The sea is a rich lapis, shot through with verdant undertones, a reversal of sky tones. A scattering of high cirrus catches the last light of Hyperion's 2 small sun, and ignites like burning coral. There is no sound except for the faintest hum of the electric turbines. 300 meters below, the shadow of a huge, manta-like undersea creature keeps pace with the dirigible. A second ago, an insect or bird the size and color of a hummingbird, but with gossamer wings 1 meter across, paused 5 meters out to inspect me, before diving toward the sea with folded wings.
Edward, I feel very alone tonight. It would help if I knew you were alive. Still working in the garden, writing evenings in your study. I thought my travels would stir my old beliefs in St. Teilhard's concept of the God in whom the Christ of evolution, the personal and the universal, the en haut and the en avant are joined. But no such renewal is forthcoming. It is growing dark. I am growing old. I feel something, not yet remorse, at my sin of falsifying the evidence on the Armagast dig. But, Edward, Your Excellency, if the artifacts had indicated the presence of a Christ-oriented culture there, 600 light-years from old Earth, almost 3,000 years before man left the surface of the home world, was it so dark a sin to interpret such ambiguous data in a way which could have meant the resurgence of Christianity in our lifetime? Yes, it was. But not, I think, because of the sin of tampering with the data, but the deeper sin of thinking that Christianity could be saved. The Church is dying, Edward. And not merely our beloved branch of the Holy Tree, but all of its offshoots, vestiges, and cankers. The entire body of Christ is dying, as surely as this poorly used body of mine, Edward. You and I knew this in Armagast, where the blood sun illuminated only dust and death. We knew it that cool, green summer at the college when we took our first vows. We knew it as boys in the quiet playfields of Villefranche-sur-Saône. We know it now. The light is gone now. I must write by the slight glow from the salon windows a deck above. The stars lie in strange constellations. The middle sea glows at night with a greenish, unhealthy phosphorescence. There is a dark mass on the horizon to the southeast. It may be a storm, or it may be the next island in the chain, the third of the 9 tails. What mythology deals with a cat with 9 tails? I know of none. For the sake of the bird I saw earlier, if it was a bird, I pray that it is an island ahead, and not a storm. Day 28. I have been in Port Romance 8 days, and I have seen 3 dead men. The first was a beached corpse, a bloated white parody of a man, that had washed up on the mudflats beyond the mooring tower my first evening in town. Children threw stones at it. The second man I watched being pulled from the burned wreckage of a methane unit shop in the poor section of town near my hotel. His body was charred beyond recognition and shrunken by the heat. His arms and legs pulled tight in the prize-fighter posture burning victims have been reduced to since time immemorial. I have been fasting all day, and I confess with shame that I began to salivate when the air filled with the rich, frying fat odor of burned flesh. The third man was murdered not 3 meters from me. I had just emerged from the hotel onto the maze of mud-splattered planks that serve as sidewalks in this miserable town, when shots rang out and a man several paces ahead of me lurched as if his foot had slipped, spun toward me with a quizzical look on his face, and fell sideways into the mud and sewage. He had been shot 3 times with some sort of projectile weapon. 2 of the bullets had struck his chest, the 3rd entered just below the left eye. Incredibly, he was still breathing when I reached him. Without thinking about it, I removed my stole from my carrying bag, fumbled for the vial of holy water I had carried for so long, and proceeded to perform the sacrament of extreme unction. No one in the gathering crowd objected. The fallen man stirred once, cleared his throat as if he were about to speak, and died. The crowd dispersed even before the body was removed. The man was middle-aged, sandy-haired, and slightly overweight. He carried no identification, not even a universal card or comm log. There were 6 silver coins in his pocket. For some reason, I elected to stay with the body the rest of that day. The doctor was a short and cynical man who allowed me to stay during the required autopsy. I suspect that he was starved for conversation. "This is what the whole thing's worth," he said, as he opened the poor man's belly like a pink satchel,
pulling the folds of skin and muscle back and pinning them down like tent flaps.
"What thing?" I asked.
"His life," said the doctor, and pulled the skin of the corpse's face up and back like a greasy mask.
"Your life, my life?"
The red and white stripes of overlapping muscle turned to blue bruise around the ragged hole just above the cheekbone.
"There has to be more than this," I said.
The doctor looked up from his grim work with a bemused smile.
"Is there?" he said. "Please show me."
He lifted the man's heart and seemed to weigh it in one hand.
"In the web worlds, this would be worth some money on the open market. There are those too poor to keep vat-grown, cloned parts on store, but too well off to die just for want of a heart. But out here it's just awful."
"There has to be more," I said,
although I felt little conviction. I remembered the funeral of His Holiness Pope Urban XV shortly before I left Pachim. As has been the custom since pre-Hegira days, the corpse was not embalmed. It waited in the anteroom off the main basilica to be fitted for the plain wooden coffin. As I helped Edouard and Monsignor Frey place the vestments on the stiffened corpse, I noticed the browning skin and slackening mouth. The doctor shrugged and finished the perfunctory autopsy. There was the briefest of formal inquiries. No suspect was found, no motive put forward. A description of the murdered man was sent to Keats, but the man himself was buried the next day in a pauper's field between the mud flats and the yellow jungle. Port Romance is a jumble of yellow, weirwood structures, set on a maze of scaffolds and planks, stretching far out onto the tidal mudflats at the mouth of the Cants. The river is almost 2 kilometers wide here, where it spills out into Toschehe Bay. But only a few channels are navigable, and the dredging goes on day and night. I lie awake each night in my cheap room with the window open, to the pounding of the dredge hammer sounding like the booming of this vile city's heart. The distant susurration of the surf, its wet breathing. Tonight I listen to the city breathe, and cannot help but give it the flayed face of the murdered man. The companies keep a skimmer port on the edge of town to ferry men and materiel inland to the larger plantations. But I do not have enough money to bribe my way aboard. Rather, I could get myself aboard, but cannot afford to transport my 3 trunks of medical and scientific gear. I am still tempted. My service among the Bikura seems more absurd and irrational now than ever before. Only my strained need for a destination and a certain masochistic determination to complete the terms of my self-imposed exile keep me moving upriver. There is a riverboat departing up the Cants in 2 days. I have booked passage and will move my trunks onto it tomorrow. It will not be hard to leave Port Romance behind.
Day 41.
The emperotic Girondole continues its slow progress upriver. No sight of human habitation since we left Melton's Landing 2 days ago. The jungle presses down to the riverbank like a solid wall now. More, it almost completely overhangs us in places, where the river narrows to 30 or 40 meters. The light itself is yellow, rich as liquid butter. Filtered as it is through foliage and fronds 80 meters above the brown surface of the Cants. I sit on the rusted tin roof of the center passenger barge and strain to make out my first glimpse of a Tesla tree. Old Katie, sitting nearby, pauses in his whittling, spits over the side through a gap in his teeth and laughs at me.
"Ain't gonna be no flame trees this far down," he says. "If they was, the forest sure as hell wouldn't look like this. You gotta get up in the pinions before you see a Tesla. We ain't out of the rainforest yet, Padre."
It rains every afternoon. Actually, rain is too gentle a term for the deluge that strikes us each day. obscuring the shore, pounding the tin roofs of the barges with a deafening roar, and slowing our upstream crawl until it seems we are standing still. It is as if the river becomes a vertical torrent each afternoon, a waterfall which the ship must climb if we are to go on. The Girondole is an ancient, flat-bottomed tow with five barges lashed around it like ragged children clinging to their tired mother's skirts. Three of the two-level barges carry bales of goods to be traded or sold at the few plantations and settlements along the river. The other two offer a simulacrum of lodging for the indigenes traveling upriver, although I suspect that some of the barges' residents are permanent. My own berth boasts a stained mattress on the floor and lizard-like insects on the walls. After the rains, everyone gathers on the decks to watch the evening mists rise from the cooling river. The air is very hot and super-saturated with moisture most of the day now. Old Katie tells me that I have come too late to make the climb through the rain and flame forests before the Tesla trees become active. We shall see. Tonight, the mists rise like the spirits of all the dead who sleep beneath the river's dark surface. The last tattered remnants of the afternoon's cloud cover dissipate through the treetops, and color returns to the world. I watch as the dense forest shifts from chrome yellow to a translucent saffron, and then slowly fades through ochre to umber to gloom. Aboard the Girondole, old Katie lights the lanterns and candle globes hanging from the sagging second tier, and, as if not to be outdone, the darkened jungle begins to glow with the faint phosphorescence of decay, while glowbirds and multi-hued gossamers can be seen floating from branch to branch in the darker upper regions. Hyperion's small moon is not visible tonight, but this world moves through more debris than is common for a planet so close to its sun, and the night skies are illuminated by frequent meteor showers. Tonight the heavens are especially fertile, and when we move on to wide sections of the river, we can see a tracery of brilliant meteor trails weaving the stars together. Their images burn the retina after a while, and I look down at the river only to see the same optic echo there in the dark waters. There is a bright glow on the eastern horizon, and old Katie tells me that this is from the orbital mirrors, which give light to a few of the larger plantations. It is too warm to return to my cabin. I spread my thin mat on the rooftop of my barge and watch the celestial light show, while clusters of indigenous families sing haunting songs in an argot I have not even tried to learn. I wonder about the Bikura, still far away from here, and a strange anxiety rises in me. Somewhere in the forest an animal screams with the voice of a frightened woman. Day 60. Arrived Paracebo Plantation. Sick. Day 62. Very ill. Fever. Fits of shaking. All yesterday I was vomiting black bile. The rain is deafening. At night the clouds are lit from above by orbital mirrors. The sky seems to be on fire. My fever is very high. A woman takes care of me, bathes me, too sick to be ashamed. Her hair is darker than most indigenes. She says little, dark, gentle eyes. Oh God, to be sick so far from home. Day. She is waiting, spying. Comes in from the rain, the thin shirt. On purpose to tempt me. Knows what I am, my skin burning on fire, thin cotton nipples. Dark against it, I know who they are watching. Hear their voices at night, they bathe me in poison, burns me, they think I don't know, but I hear their voices above the rain when the screaming stops. Stop, stop. My skin is almost gone. Red underneath, can feel the hole in my cheek. When I find the bullet, I will spit it out
it out. Agnus Dei quitoli specta ta mundi miserere nobis, misere nobis, miserere.
Day 65. Thank you, dear Lord, for deliverance from illness. Day 66. Shaved today. Was able to make it to the shower. Sempha helped me prepare for the administrator's visit. I expected him to be one of the large, gruff types I have seen out the window, working in the sorting compound. But he was a quiet black man with a slight lisp. He was most helpful. I had been concerned about paying for my medical care, but he reassured me that there would be no charge. Even better, he will assign a man to lead me into the high country. He says it is late in the season, but if I can travel, in 10 days we should be able to make it through the flame forest to the cleft before the Tesla trees are fully active. After he left, I sat and talked to Sempha a bit. Her husband died here 3 local months ago in a harvesting accident. Sempha herself had come from Port Romance. Her marriage to Michael had been a salvation for her, and she has chosen to stay on here doing odd jobs rather than go back downriver. I do not blame her. After a massage, I will sleep. Many dreams about my mother recently. 10 days. I will be ready in 10 days. Day 75. Before leaving with Tuck, I went down to the Matrix Paddies to say goodbye to Sempha. She said little, but I could see in her eyes that she was sad to see me go. Without premeditation, I blessed her and then kissed her on the forehead. Tuck stood nearby, smiling and bobbing. Then we were off, leading the 2 packbrids. Supervisor Orlandi came to the end of the road and waved as we entered the narrow lane hacked into the aureate foliage. Domine, dirige nos. Day 82. After a week on the trail. What trail? After a week in the trackless yellow rainforest. After a week of exhausting climb up the ever-steeper shoulder of the Pinyon Plateau, we emerged this morning onto a rocky outcropping that allowed us a view back across an expanse of jungle toward the beak in the Middle Sea. The plateau here is almost 3,000 meters above sea level, and the view was impressive. Heavy rain clouds spread out below us to the foot of the Pinyon Hills, but through gaps in the white and gray carpet of cloud, we caught glimpses of the Khans, in its leisurely uncoiling toward Port R, and the sea, chrome-yellow swatches of the forest we had struggled through, and a hint of magenta far to the east. The Tuck swore was a lower matrix of fiber-plastic fields near Peresibo. We continued onward and upward late into the evening. Tuck is obviously worried that we will be caught in the flame forests when the Tesla trees become active. I struggled to keep up, tugging at the heavily laden brid and saying silent prayers to keep my mind off my aches, pains, and general misgivings. Day 83. Loaded and moving before dawn today. The air smells of smoke and ashes. The change in vegetation here on the plateau is startling. No longer evident are the ubiquitous werewood and leafy chalma. After passing through an intermediate zone of short evergreens and everblues, then after climbing again through dense strands of mutated lodgepole pines and triaspen, we came into the flame forest proper, with its groves of tall Prometheus, trailers of ever-present phoenix, and round stands of amber lambents. Occasionally, we encountered impenetrable breaks of the white fibrous, bifurcated bestos plants that Tuck picturesquely referred to as looking like the rotting cocks of some dead giants, what be buried shallow here, that be sure. My guide has a way with words. It was late afternoon before we saw our first Tesla tree.
For half an hour we had been trudging over an ash-covered forest floor, trying not to tread on the tender shoots of phoenix and fire whip, gamely pushing up through the sooty soil, when suddenly Tuck stopped and pointed. The Tesla tree, still half a kilometer away, stood at least 100 meters tall, half again as high as the tallest Prometheus. Near its crown it bulged with the distinctive onion-shaped dome of its accumulator gall. The radial branches above the gall trailed dozens of nimbus vines, each looking silver and metallic against the clear green and lapis sky. The whole thing made me think of some elegant, high Muslim mosque on New Mecca, irreverently garlanded with tinsel.
"We got to get the brids and our asses the hell out of here," grunted Tuck.
He insisted that we change into flame forest gear right then and there. We spent the rest of the afternoon and evening trudging on in our osmosis masks and thick, rubber-soled boots, sweating under layers of leathery gamma cloth. Both of the brids acted nervous, their long ears pricking at the slightest sound. Even through my mask I could smell the ozone. It reminded me of electric trains I had played with as a child on lazy Christmas Day afternoons in Villefranche-sur-Saône. "We are camping as close as we can to a Bestos break this night. Tuck showed me how to set out the ring of arrestor rods, all the time clucking dire warnings to himself and searching the evening sky for clouds. I plan to sleep well in spite of everything." Day 84. Oh, 400 hours. Sweet Mother of Christ. For 3 hours we have been caught up in the middle of the end of the world. The explosion started shortly after midnight, mere lightning crashes at first, and against our better judgment, Tuck and I slid our heads through the tent flap to watch the pyrotechnics. I am used to the Matthew month monsoon storms on Pachim, so the first hour of lightning displays did not seem too unusual. Only the sight of distant Tesla trees as the unerring focus of the aerial discharge was a bit unnerving. But soon the forest behemoths were glowing and spitting with their own accumulated energy, and then, just as I was drifting off to sleep despite the continued noise, true Armageddon was unleashed. At least 100 arcs of electricity must have been released in the first 10 seconds of the Tesla tree's opening spasms of violent energy. A Prometheus, less than 30 meters from us, exploded, dropping flaming brands 50 meters to the forest floor. The arrestor rods glowed, hissed, and deflected arc after arc of blue-white death over and around our small campsite. Tuck screamed something, but no mere human sound was audible over the onslaught of light and noise. A patch of trailing phoenix burst into flame near the tethered brids, and one of the terrified animals, hobbled and blindfolded as it was, broke free and lunged through the circle of glowing arrestor rods. Instantly, half a dozen bolts of lightning from the nearest Tesla arced to the hapless animal. For a mad second, I could have sworn I saw the beast's skeleton glowing through boiling flesh, and then it spasmed high into the air and simply ceased to be. For 3 hours we have watched the end of the world. Two of the arrestor rods have fallen, but the other 8 continue to function. Tuck and I huddle in the hot cave of our tent, osmosis masks filtering enough cool oxygen out of the superheated, smoky air to allow us to breathe. Only the lack of undergrowth and Tuck's skill in placing our tent away from other targets and near the sheltering Bestos plants have allowed us to survive. That, and the 8 whiskered alloy rods that stand between us and eternity. "They seem to be holding up well," I shout to Tuck over the hiss and crackle, crash and split of the storm.
"Dey be made to stand a hour, maybe 2, grunts my guide. "Any time, maybe sooner, dey fuse, we die."
I nod and sip at lukewarm water through the slipstrip of my osmosis mask. If I survive this night, I shall always thank God for his generosity in allowing me to see this sight. Day 87. Tuck and I emerged from the smoldering northeastern edge of the flame forest at noon yesterday. Promptly set up camp by the edge of a small stream and slept for 18 hours straight, making up for 3 nights of no sleep and 2 grueling days moving without rest through a nightmare of flame and ash. Everywhere we looked as we approached the hogback ridge that marked the terminus of the forest, we could see seed pods and cones burst open with new life for the various fire species that had died in the conflagration of the previous 2 nights. 5 of our arrestor rods still functioned, although neither Tuck nor I was eager to test them another night. Our surviving packbrid collapsed and died the instant the heavy load was lifted off its back. I awoke this morning at dawn to the sound of running water. I followed the small stream 1 kilometer to the northeast, following a deepening in its sound, until suddenly it dropped from sight. The cleft. I had almost forgotten our destination. This morning, stumbling through the fog, leaping from one wet rock to another alongside the widening stream, I took a leap to a final boulder, teetered there, regained my balance, and looked straight down above a waterfall that dropped almost 3,000 meters to mist, rock, and river far below. The cleft was not carved out of the rising plateau, as was the legendary Grand Canyon on Old Earth, or World Crack on Hebron. In spite of its active oceans and seemingly Earth-like continents, Hyperion is tectonically quite dead. More like Mars, Lussis, or Armagast in its total lack of continental drift. And like Mars and Lussis, Hyperion is afflicted with its deep ice ages. Although here, the periodicity is spread to 37 million years by the long ellipse of the currently absent binary dwarf. The comm log compares the cleft to the pre-terraformed Mariner Valley on Mars, both being caused by the weakening of crust through periodic freeze and thaw over the eons, followed by the flow of subterranean rivers such as the Khans. Then the massive collapse, running like a long scar through the mountainous wing of the continent Aquila. Tuck joined me as I stood on the edge of the cleft. I was naked, rinsing the ash smell from my traveling clothes and cassock. I splashed cold water over my pale flesh and laughed out loud as the echo of Tuck's shouts came back from the north wall, 2/3 of a kilometer away. Because of the nature of the crust collapse, Tuck and I stood far out on an overhang that hid the south wall below us. Although perilously exposed, we assumed that the rocky cornice which had defied gravity for millions of years would last a few more hours, as we bathed, relaxed, shouted echoing hellos until we were hoarse, and generally acted like children liberated from school. Tuck confessed that he had never penetrated the full width of the flame forest, nor known anyone who had in this season, and announced that, now that the Tesla trees were becoming fully active, he would have at least a 3-month wait until he could return. He did not seem too sorry, and I was glad to have him with me. In the afternoon, we transported my gear in relays, setting up camp near the stream 100 meters back from the cornice, and stacking my flow foam boxes of scientific gear for further sorting in the morning. It was cold this evening. After dinner, just before sunset, I pulled on my thermal jacket and walked alone to a rocky ledge southwest of where I had first encountered the cleft. From my vantage point, far out over the river, the view was memorable. Mists rose from unseen waterfalls, tumbling to the river far below. Spray rising and shifting curtains of mist to multiply the setting sun into 12 violet spheres and 2x that many rainbows. I watched as each spectrum was born, rose toward the darkening dome of sky and died. As the cooling air settled into the cracks and caverns of the plateau and the warm air rushed skyward, pulling leaves, twigs, and mist upward in a vertical gale, A sound ebbed up out of the cleft, as if the continent itself was calling with the voices of stone giants. Gigantic bamboo flutes, church organs the size of palaces. The clear, perfect notes ranging from the shrillest soprano to the deepest bass. I speculated on wind vectors against the fluted rock walls, on caverns far below, venting deep cracks in the motionless crust, and on the illusion of human voices that random harmonics can generate. But in the end, I set aside speculation, and simply listened as the cleft sang its farewell hymn to the sun. I walked back to our tent, and its circle of bioluminescent lantern light, as the first fusillade of meteor showers burned the skies overhead, and distant explosions from the flame forests rippled along the southern and western horizons, like cannon fire from some ancient war on pre-Hegira old Earth. Once in the tent, I tried the long-range comlog bands, but there is nothing but static. I suspect that even if the primitive commsats that serve the fiber-plastic plantations were ever to broadcast this far east, anything but the tightest laser or fatline beams would be masked by the mountains and Tesla activity. On Pacham, few of us at the monastery wore or carried personal comlogs, but the datasphere was always there if we needed to tap into it. Here there is no choice. I sit and listen to the last notes from the canyon wind die, watch the skies simultaneously darken and blaze, smile at the sound of Tuck snoring from his bedroll outside the tent, and I think to myself, if this is exile, so be it. Day 88. Tuck is dead. Murdered. I found his body when I left the tent at sunrise. He had been sleeping outside, not more than 4 meters from me. He had said that he wished to sleep under the stars. The murderers cut his throat while he slept. I heard no cry. I did dream, however. Dreams of Sempha ministering to me during my fever. Dreams of cool hands touching my neck and chest, touching the crucifix I have worn since childhood. I stood over Tuck's body, staring at the wide, dark circle where his blood had soaked into Hyperion's uncaring soil, and I shivered at the thought that the dream had been more than a dream, that hands had touched me in the night. I confess that I reacted more like a frightened old fool than as a priest. I did administer extreme unction, but then the panic struck me, and I left my poor guide's body, desperately searched through the supplies for a weapon, and took away the machete I had used in the rainforest, and the low-voltage maser with which I had planned to hunt small game. Whether I would have used a weapon on a human being, even to save my own life, I do not know. But in my panic, I carried the machete, the maser, and the powered binoculars to a high boulder near the cleft and searched the region for any sign of the murderers. Nothing stirred, except the tiny arboreals and gossamers we had seen flitting through the trees yesterday. The forest itself seemed abnormally thick and dark. The cleft offered 100 terraces, ledges, and rock balconies to the northeast for entire bands of savages. An army could have hidden there in the crags and ever-present mists. After 30 minutes of fruitless vigilance and foolish cowardice, I returned to the campsite and prepared Tuck's body for burial. It took me well over 2 hours to dig a proper grave in the rocky soil of the plateau. When it was filled and the formal service was finished, I could think of nothing personal to say about the rough, funny little man who had been my guide. "Watch over him, Lord," I said at last, disgusted at my own hypocrisy, sure in my heart that I was mouthing words only to myself. give him safe passage. Amen. This evening I have moved my camp half a kilometer north. My tent is pitched in an open area 10 meters away, but I am wedged with my back against the boulder, sleeping robes pulled around, the machete and mazer nearby. After Tuck's funeral, I went through the supplies and boxes of equipment. Nothing had been taken, except for the few remaining arrestor rods. Immediately I wondered if someone had followed us through the flame forest in order to kill Tuck and strand me here, but I could think of no motive for such an elaborate action. Anyone from the plantations could have killed us as we slept in the rainforest, or, better yet from a murderer's point of view, deep in the flame forest, where no one would wonder at 2 charred corpses. That left the Bikura. My primitive charges. I considered returning through the flame forest without the rods, but soon abandoned the idea. It is probable death to stay, and certain death to go. 3 months before the Teslas become dormant. 120 of the 26-hour local days. An eternity. Dear Christ, why has this come to me? And why was I spared last night if I am merely to be offered up this night, or next? I sit here in the darkening crag, and I listen to the suddenly ominous moaning rising with the night wind from the cleft, and I pray, as the sky lights with the blood-red streaks of meteor trails, mouthing words to myself. Day 95. The terrors of the past week have largely abated. I find that even fear fades and becomes commonplace after days of anticlimax. I use the machete to cut small trees for a lean-to, covering the roof and side with gamma cloth and caulking between the logs with mud. The back wall is the solid stone of the boulder. I have sorted through my research gear and set some of it out, although I suspect that I will never use it now. I have begun foraging to supplement my quickly diminishing cache of freeze-dried food. By now, according to the absurd schedule drawn up so long ago on Pacham, I was to have been living with the Bikura for some weeks and trading small goods for local food. No matter. Besides my diet of bland but easily boiled chalma roots, I have found 6 varieties of berries and larger fruits that the comlog assures me are edible. So far, only one has disagreed with me enough to keep me squatting all night near the edge of the nearest ravine. I pace the confines of the region as restlessly as one of those caged pelops that were so prized by the minor padishahs on Armagast. 1 kilometer to the south and 4 to the west, the flame forest are in full form. In the morning, smoke vies with the shifting curtains of mist to hide the sky. Only the near solid breaks of Bestos, the rocky soil here on the summit plateau, and the hogback ridges running like armor-plated vertebrae northeast from here keep the Teslas at bay. To the north, the plateau widens out and the undergrowth becomes denser near the cleft for some 15 kilometers, until the way is blocked by a ravine 1/3 as deep and 1/2 as wide as the cleft itself. Yesterday, I reached this northernmost point and stared across the gaping barrier with some frustration. I will try again someday, detouring to the east to find a crossing point. But from the telltale signs of Phoenix across the chasm, and the pall of smoke along the northeastern horizon, I suspect I will find only the chalma-filled canyons and steppes of flame forest that are roughed in on the orbital survey map I carry. Tonight, I visited Tuck's rocky grave as the evening wind began to wail its aeolian dirge. I knelt there and tried to pray, but nothing came. Edward, nothing came. I am as empty as those fake sarcophagi that you and I unearthed by the score from the sterile desert sands near Tarim Belwadi.
The Zen Gnostics would say that this emptiness is a good sign, that it presages openness to a new level of awareness, new insights, new experience. Mailed. My emptiness is only emptiness. Day 96. I have found the Bikura. Or rather, they have found me. I will write what I can before they come to rouse me from my sleep. Today I was doing some detail mapping a mere 4 kilometers north of camp, when the mists lifted in the midday warmth, and I noticed a series of terraces on my side of the cleft that had been hidden until then. I was using my powered glasses to inspect the terraces, actually a series of laddered ledges, spires, shelves, and tussocks extending far out onto the overhang, when I realized that I was staring at man-made habitations. The dozen or so huts were crude, rough hovels of heaped chalma fronds, stones, and sponge turf, but they were unmistakably of human origin. I was standing there, irresolute, binoculars still lifted, trying to decide whether to climb down to the exposed ledges and confront the inhabitants or to retreat to my camp, when I felt that lifting chill along the back and neck that tells one with absolute certainty that he is no longer alone. I lowered the binoculars and turned slowly. The Bikura were there, at least 30 of them, standing in a semicircle that left me no retreat to the forest. I do not know what I expected. Naked savages, perhaps, with fierce expressions and necklaces of teeth. Perhaps I had half expected to find the kind of bearded, wild-haired hermits that travelers sometimes encountered in the Moshe Mountains on Hebron. Whatever I had held in mind, the reality of the Bikura did not fit the template. The people who had approached me so silently were short. None came higher than my shoulder, and swathed in roughly woven dark robes that covered them from neck to toe. When they moved, as some did now, they seemed to glide over the rough ground like wraiths. From a distance, their appearance reminded me of nothing so much as a gaggle of diminutive Jesuits at a new Vatican enclave. I almost giggled then, but realized that such a response might well be a sign of rising panic. The Bikura showed no outward signs of aggression to cause such a panic. They carried no weapons, their small hands were empty as their expressions. Their physiognomy is hard to describe succinctly. They are bald, all of them. That baldness, the absence of any facial hair, and the loose robes that fell in a straight line to the ground, all conspired to make it very difficult to tell the men from the women. The group now confronting me, more than 50 by this time, looked to be all of roughly the same age, somewhere between 40 and 50 standard years. Their faces were smooth, the skin tinged with a yellowish cast that I guessed might be associated with generations of ingesting trace minerals in the chalma and other local plant life. One might be tempted to describe the round faces of the Bikura as cherubic until, upon closer inspection, that impression of sweetness fades and is replaced by another interpretation, placid idiocy. As a priest, I have spent enough time on backward worlds to see the effects of an ancient genetic disorder, variously called Down syndrome, Mongolism, or generation ship legacy. This, then, was the overall impression created by the 60 or so dark-robed little people who had approached me. I was being greeted by a silent, smiling band of bald, retarded children. I reminded myself that these were almost certainly the same group of smiling children who had slit Tuck's throat while he slept and left him to die like a butchered pig. The closest Bikura stepped forward, stopped 5 paces from me, and said something in a soft monotone. "Just a minute," I said, and fumbled out my comm log,
I tapped in the translator function.
Betet otamena lot kresfemket?
Asked the short man in front of me. I slipped on the hear plug just in time to hear the comlog's translation. There was no lag time. The apparently foreign language was a simple corruption of archaic seedship English, not so far removed from the indigene argo of the plantations.
You are the man who belongs to the cross-shaped cruciform?
Interpreted the comlog, giving me two choices for the final noun. Yes, I said, knowing now that these were the ones who had touched me the night I slept through Tuck's murder. Which meant that these were the ones who had murdered Tuck. I waited. The hunting mazer was in my pack. The pack was set against a small chalma, not 10 paces from me. Half a dozen Bikura stood between me and it. It did not matter. I knew at that instant that I would not use a weapon against another human being, even a human being who had murdered my guide and might well be planning to murder me at any second. I closed my eyes and said a silent act of contrition. When I opened my eyes, more of the Bikura had arrived. There was a cessation of movement, as if a quorum had been filled, a decision reached. Yes, I said again into the silence. I am the one who wears the cross. I heard the comlog speaker pronounce the last word, Kresfem. The Bikura nodded in unison and, as if from long practice as altar boys, all went to one knee, robes rustling softly in a perfect genuflection. I opened my mouth to speak and found that I had nothing to say. I closed my mouth. The Bikura stood. A breeze moved the brittle chalma fronds and leaves together to make a dry, end-of-summer sound above us. The Bikura nearest to me on the left stepped closer, grasped my forearm with a touch of cool, strong fingers, and spoke a soft sentence that my comlog translated as, "Come, it is time to go to the houses and sleep." It was mid-afternoon. Wondering if the comlog had translated the word sleep properly, or if it might be an idiom or metaphor for die, I nodded and followed them toward the village at the edge of the cleft. Now I sit in the hut and wait. There are rustling sounds. Someone else is awake now. I sit and wait.
Day 97. The Bikura call themselves the 80. I have spent the past 26 hours talking to them, observing, making notes when they take their 2-hour, mid-afternoon sleep, and generally trying to record as much data as I can before they decide to slit my throat. Except now I am beginning to believe that they will not hurt me. I spoke to them yesterday after our sleep. Sometimes they do not respond to questions, and when they do, the responses are little better than the grunts or divergent answers one receives from slow children. After their initial question and invitation at our first encounter, none of them originated a single query or comment my way. I questioned them subtly, carefully, cautiously, and with the professional calm of a trained ethnologist. I asked the simplest, most factual questions possible to make sure that the comlog was functioning properly. It was. But the sum total of the answers left me almost as ignorant as I had been 20-some hours before. Finally, tired in body and spirit, I abandoned professional subtlety and asked the group I